Hello, and welcome to The X-Ray. I'm Fernando Espuelas. Today I speak with former Republican Congressman Reid Ribble. Congressman Ribble is an unusual figure. After pledging to only serve three terms, he actually retired. This is basically unheard of in Washington, where elected officials glue themselves to their posts and refuse to leave. He was a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is possibly the most optimistic grouping of members of Congress. They actually believe they're in Washington to solve America's problems. Quite the radical idea. And a bit later, we'll have our unconventional The X-Ray Vision interview, trying to understand the real person behind the political title. I'll be speaking to another former congressman, Zach Womp. He's pretty focused on fixing problems in Washington. But first, here's my conversation with Congressman Reid Ribble. Congressman Reid Ribble, welcome to The X-Ray.
Man, it's good to be with you. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you, sir. Let me start out. What's the impact of the political system of the recent indictment of former President Donald Trump?
You know, I think that's a story that's still unfolding, because I don't think it's going to be just the indictment in New York. I think there's likely to be others coming either out of the state of Georgia or from the January 6th or Mar-a-Lago cases, and all of those will have some impact. And if you look at it just from the New York perspective, I think President Trump got a bit of a bump from the base. You know, people are wanting to defend him because they see that the charges as being weak simply because they're beyond the statute of limitations for a normal person living in New York. But on the same hand, I don't know that that can sustain itself.
Mm-hmm. And it's fair to say that if you or I had undertaken the same actions that he did, we'd be indicted, right? We wouldn't be spared. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, this has been my heartburn all along with this particular, well, with President Trump and in all the cases that he's been up against. First of all, he's skilled in using the court system. He had been in, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 lawsuits even before he was elected. So he knew how to use the court system to delay and delay and delay until he would eventually wear opponents out or have them run out of money. But from a truly legal system, we should be considering the fact that the most poor American, the lowest among us, whomever that might be, if they're treated one way, then the most elite among us must also be treated the same, up to and including a former president of the United States. Otherwise, we don't really have equal justice. Otherwise, you might as well tear Lady Liberty off the wall, and her blindfolded balances in her hand mean nothing.
And ultimately, that's the essence of a Republican form of government, right? That we are all equal before the law, that there are no special privileges, no titles can save you. There's no dukes and duchesses that, put you beyond the reach of the law.
This is exactly right. I mean, that's what our former government did prior to the United States coming on the scene and the revolution that took place. And most importantly, our Constitution being written, the sovereign was the law. The king, the monarch, the totalitarian ruler was the law. And here what we're saying is the sovereign are the people. And then the law must reign and treat every single person, rich or poor, powerful or weak, the same.
One of the things that I think is very notable when you look at the situation and you compare it to what had been some of the essential pillars of the Republican Party, and one of them was character. Character mattered. Character was the beginning and end of good governance. Without good character, what do you have? And we seem to have here in this particular person, Donald Trump, someone of, dare I say, a dubious character, because this is not the first case, as you pointed out. He's been investigated by the Department of Justice all the way back in the 1970s, and from there, other somewhat scandalous situations have occurred in his life. How do you reconcile that idea of character with his popularity?
It's irreconcilable. You can't reconcile it. I mean, stop and think of the journey that conservatives, particularly those in the evangelical movement, have gone through. From Jerry Falwell back in the 1980s, starting the, I'm using this in quotes, moral majority, where morality was a key tenet of leadership. It was a key requirement of evangelicals that there would be a person who would uphold the highest moral standards and demonstrate that through their leadership to achieve any of the highest positions in the land, to the point where, hey, we're not trying to vote in a pastor here. We want someone who's going to fight for us. And, you know, the interesting thing, if I could just stay on this religious theme for just a second, the interesting thing to me, and by the way, I'm evangelical myself, and I've been troubled by the movement because of their support for Donald Trump. But what troubles me is they're saying that God cannot fight for us. So therefore, we have to hire someone to do it. This is so akin to the Israelis in King David's time, where they said, give us a king. And this is exactly the circle that has been turned now, where they're ignoring morality, but they just want the strong man to force onto everybody else their views and opinions. And that is in and of itself a danger to the republic. But at the end of the day, voters did vote in President Trump over Hillary Clinton. He did win that election. Now, he lost the one against President Biden, but he did win that. So apparently the American people in the aggregate no longer care that much about morality.
Congressman, let me ask you about sort of the impact of Donald Trump to our very sense of objective reality, to the truth. The truth is critical in a democracy. I mean, I'm saying the painfully obvious thing. Just in the last few days, Trump continues to claim that the 2020 election was stolen, even though there's absolutely not even remotely any evidence of that. Quite the contrary, as it has been reported recently, he actually commissioned a very expensive report, which informed him at the time that there was absolutely no fraud, or fraud that was not remotely at the level where it could impact the end of the election. So you have that claim, which he repeats at every speech, and you have the surging support from certain voters. What's happening to the truth inside the Republican Party? Why is that not something that carries more weight?
You know, I think that that question is connected to the previous one, because there is a morality-related issue on this as well. They're interconnected. We're living in a post-truth era. And politicians from both sides of the aisle, President Trump was particularly skilled at it, are telling people what they want to hear. My dad was a Southern Baptist minister, and he had a small roof construction company. And he told me once, he said, just remember this, it is always easier to scam somebody than it is to convince somebody that they've been scammed. And there's just some very reality to that. And hucksters and people like Donald Trump have been around our society for, well, they've been in society forever. And they realize that there is a group of people, a construct of citizens, that want to hear a predetermined belief. And they want to be fed what they believe. And now we have a media system in the country that citizens are going and listening to just things that affirm their predetermined belief. Yes, yeah, so there's a confirmation bias that is extraordinarily strong, and nobody wants to actually be challenged in their thinking and be forced into doing critical thinking. Another thing, and I won't talk too much about my dad, he's gone, but he also taught me that I needed to spend more time looking in a mirror than looking out of a window. And the idea there is that unless you're willing to be introspective at any given moment of time when you want to blame somebody else, the first place you must look is, did I cause this and what role am I playing in it? And I think as a society, the American people need to begin looking in a mirror a little bit and saying, what role did I play in this post-truth era? How am I contributing to it by saying part truths and half truths? And when I was in Congress, I described it. I would often speak before audiences back home in Wisconsin. I'd hold up a pencil and I would say, let's just say that inside this pencil contains all truth about a particular topic. And then I would move my hand over to one side where I would expose just about 1 inch of the pencil. And I said, now, if I told you just this 1 inch of the truth, and it is the truth, but knowing full well in my mind that if I ignore all the rest of this over here, that I'm misleading you. And so while I'm speaking the truth, I am not being truthful. And so you cannot learn the fullness of truth. And that's where we're at in our political cycles today, is they're telling you just what you want to hear inside your own confirmation bias to reaffirm and then say, oh, I like this person because he and I believe the same. But you might believe something totally different if you had all the truth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let me ask you, I mean, I think that's, you're almost describing how social media works, right? Which is completely cherry-picked information, disinformation, all aggregated or disaggregated, I guess would be a better way of putting it. What do you think is the responsibility of social media companies to adhere to the truth? Do they have any responsibility? I know legally they technically don't. But do you think they should? I mean, if I run a TV station and I start to lie on air or say crazy things, a broadcast station, I should say, there are rules against that. There are mechanisms to control what I'm doing on air. I have liabilities attached to it and so forth. So should social media companies equally have that kind of responsibility?
You know, my opinion has been evolving on this topic. And I think I'm probably like a lot of Americans, and you're looking at the damage that social media can do with the ability to provide both disinformation and misinformation and have it go to broad audiences. And so at some point, I do think that there has to be some accountability. How we go about that while staying true and committed to our First Amendment principles of freedom of speech. You know, there really is a guarantee that you and I can, on this program, say any stupid thing we want, you know, and then the audience must make a judgment as to whether or not there's any intelligent nuggets in this discussion at all. And that has been kind of core to who we are as Americans. But I don't know that anybody, certainly our founders could never have envisioned a way of communication that was so instantaneous and could catch fire in the way that things can happen through Twitter and Instagram and TikTok. And you can name them all. And it does allow a great deal of misinformation to be put at play, and not even necessarily by American citizens, but by foreign adversaries that may seek to do damage to the United States using that freedom of speech that they themselves don't allow in their own country.
Right. Well, I mean, TikTok obviously is something that is emerging as a huge risk, right? I mean, it's basically allowing a foreign power to have direct access to, I don't know, 100 million of our citizens, right? At any moment, they could press a button.
And all these algorithms that they can feed whatever information that you want right into your home. And, you know, TikTok is interesting because the Chinese government themselves are one of the most egregious about restricting information to their own citizens. Most Chinese don't know anything about Tiananmen Square.
Right. It's horrifying, really, at the most basic level. I mean, it's almost like we're out of control as a society. We have no mechanism to rein it back in.
That's right. And I mean, I think policymakers want to do something here. I really believe that both sides of the aisle, left and right, want to do something, but they're struggling with how do you do it in this era? And to be fair to them, and sometimes I'm not always fair to members of Congress who are working hard, to be fair to them, I would like them to be contemplative as they go about this so that they get it right to the degree you can get it right.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you were part of the Problem Solvers Caucus, which sounds almost quaint because there are not a lot of problems being solved. A lot of problems generated, but not a lot solved. Do you think Congress can, and Congress was always messy. It was designed to be messy. It's the people's representative, so it's going to be messy. But do you think that Congress can somehow take a bit of a leap and go back to solving problems on a more systemic basis?
I actually think, and this might be controversial in some quarters, I actually think that the debate that occurred centered around Speaker of the House McCarthy's election to Speaker was a step in the right direction in opening up this deliberative process that's required. When I was there, we hardly could offer any amendments. We couldn't perfect any bill. It was often coming from leadership, and it was a take it or leave it kind of thing. Amendments weren't allowed on the floor. And then, of course, you want to be a team player, you wanted to support what your party was doing, you would often feel lots of pressure to vote for it. And some of the changes that they demanded, I think, while it will make it slower, it will make it messier, it does allow for legitimate debate to happen on the floor of the House. Because if you're going to offer an amendment, you've got to go offer it, and you've got to defend it, and you've got to force the body to vote on it. And I think that that was a step in the right direction. Now, not everything that they did, I think, was best in the best interest. And I think they left some opportunities for improvement on the table. For example, they should have allowed each of the committees to have the committee members select their chairman rather than have the chairman appointed by the leadership. Because now that chairman is subject to the leadership rather than subject to the members. So anything we can do to invert the pyramid of power and put individual members of Congress who represent 700,000 citizens back into seats of power, that I think the more efficiently and the more in bipartisan fashion the Congress can actually function.
We're coming to an end, but you just brought up something I'm very curious about. Bipartisanship is a value that we all at least make sounds that we like. Yes, if it were bipartisan, it would be so much better and so forth. Is that possible nowadays? Is it?
Well, it isn't in the moment, because I don't think leadership wants it to be. When I first got elected, John Boehner was the Speaker of the House, and his rule in the Republican conference, so we're in the majority, was he was going to follow the Hastert rule, meaning no bill would come to the floor without a majority of the majority. Now, if we had 240 people, that's only 120 of us had to agree to move something forward. But later, as Paul Ryan became Speaker, he was under intense pressure because of the way Boehner was removed from office to only bring bills that we could pass on our own. If we didn't have 218 votes, it didn't come to the floor. So that in and of itself became, it pushed against the bipartisan need. And I think there's some wisdom to the Hastert rule, because the American people put whatever party in charge. So certainly they should lead the agenda. But the idea that each party now must move only legislation that they can do on their own, that's not good for the Republic at all.
Right. I mean, it just by definition, right, it will create minority bills.
That's correct. By its very nature, it just cannot work. And all the big legislation that's been passed in the last decade or so have been passed in very partisan manner.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a final question, Congressman. This is a heavy time for the American people and for those of us living in Washington. You got away. But the rest of us who are here, it feels dark. It feels like, you know, there's not a lot of hope. But I'm wondering if you, from your perspective, having served in the House of Representatives and now looking at it from a bit of distance, still involved, but from a little bit of distance, are you at all optimistic?
I am. I really believe in the American ideal. And I think that there are more people in Congress that believe in it than what we think believe in it. And at the end of the day, the American people have proven over and over again the ability to pivot. We are in a period right now, not just a post-truth period, but we're in a populist period. And if you look at history, we've had some populist presidents that have come before. You can take a look at Andrew Jackson. You can take a look at Teddy Roosevelt. You can take a look at Woodrow Wilson. We're all populists. But there's been a reset that's occurred after those presidencies. And there will be a reset here again. And so, yes, I'm optimistic because I have a great deal of confidence in the next generations and the one behind them. And my grandson is 19 years old. He's a brilliant young man. And I'm thinking, you know what? These kids are going to be okay.
All right. Well, that's great. I'm glad someone's optimistic, and I'm glad I got a chance to speak with that person. Congressman Reed Ribble, thank you so much for taking time to speak to the X-Ray today.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And now for something completely different. The X-Ray Vision interview is our search for the real person behind the political title. Today, I speak with former Congressman Zach Wamp, Republican of Tennessee. He served with distinction in the House from 1995 to 2011 and was part of the rich history of that era. Congressman Wamp is now focused on reforming our highly dysfunctional Congress. Here's our conversation. Zach Wamp, welcome to the X-Ray Vision.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir. Let's start out with who is your hero?
Politically, Ronald Reagan, really in the modern era. Lincoln, historically, is because he took us through such difficult challenges. But then I guess in my personal life, in many ways, both of my kids are my heroes because I'm sort of living my good life through them now.
Oh, that's nice. If you could tell something to the founders, what would it be?
That they were right, that this is really hard, and that it can come unraveled and that they were correct. And the warnings that they gave us about our challenges domestically were absolutely correct, that we've stood really well against the foreign adversaries, but that our risk in the modern era are internal more than external.
That was pretty geniusy of them, right? To see that almost 300 years into the future.
It really is kind of supernatural. I don't really know how it happened, but it somehow was a supernatural type thing, because they set up a system and they almost predicted how it would play out. Yeah. And somehow that's beyond the norm.
Right. If you were running for president, what would be your campaign's colors?
Well, if I were running, it would clearly be country over party. We're not going to get pulled in any one direction. We're going to follow the guiding principles, traditions, and norms that have made America great and strong for 250 years. And we're not going to kowtow to any of the preconceived notions about how we're supposed to govern.
Boy, that sounded a bit like an announcement. Are you announcing today?
No, but somebody needs to on that same platform.
Okay. Do you think there are too many Congress people or too few senators?
Well, we used to laugh when I was in the House and say that the Senate is where House members go when they die. And that's not true. But to be honest with you, it swung back and forth in my mind, because at times I thought the House was really where the action was, because that's where the life is. And that's what the framers envisioned in the 2-year term. And, you know, the passions of the House would, you know, cool in the Senate, et cetera. But then there have been times of recent note where the Senate has in fact done exactly what they were supposed to do. And like Mitch McConnell and the election fraud narrative, frankly, I'm really proud of the Republican senators that actually stood their ground. So, you know, it goes back and forth with me. One day I'm a fan of the Senate and one day I'm a fan of the House.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's your Sunday morning passion?
Well, every morning now at 65 years old is different than it used to be. I used to hit the ground running and not want to stop until I was exhausted. Now, every morning, including Sunday, Sunday's a special day, but every morning begins with calm. I walk every morning after I actually look at different things. I look at secular verses, so to speak, and spiritual verses, so to speak. I get myself going in a different pattern. And I really don't even surface till after 9 in the morning, but the early mornings before the sun comes up, I am kind of busy digging into things so that I get the day started from the right perspective. And that just comes with age.
You look very young, I have to say. Maybe it's a Zoom dynamic or whatever, but you don't look even close to 65. So whatever you're doing, it's working. Which historical figure do you most identify with?
Maybe Gandhi. I say this because the U.S. historical figures, you can't even put yourself in Lincoln's shoes, or even in the modern era, Eisenhower, people that I admire. But in terms of Gandhi, it's kind of a combination of leadership from the spiritual realm and the secular realm. And I think I cross both. My grandmother told me, she passed away after I was elected, before I was sworn in, that she always thought I was either going to be a preacher or a politician. And I actually told my family, In the best sense of the way, I really tried to be both. And I don't mean that in terms of like evangelism as much as just kind of pastoral care for people. Mm-hmm. I think a good politician is in tune with people's needs as much as they are serving, you know, in the public sphere. And so maybe Gandhi.
Okay. And then to balance that question, which living person do you most despise?
Oh, that's even hard, because I try not to hate anyone. And in terms of despise, man, that's really hard. I'm drawn to the popular culture and some, you know, Hollywood zealot, but I don't even want to name a name. I mean, so somebody who frankly is totally of the flesh and not in any way decent and kind. But I don't even want to pick a fight with anybody, so I'm going to have to pass.
Very pure of heart there, Zach. I can tell. And then last question, scotch or bourbon?
See, that's another thing about me, I think, that is part of who I am, is that I have been sober for 39 and a half years.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
And But I will say that in the 5 years leading into that beginning, probably drank enough in 5 years for most people's lives. And that's one reason why I haven't drank in 39 and a half years. And so I would just say this, prior to 25 years old, it clearly would have been Jack Daniels.
All right. Zach Womp, thank you so much for joining the X-Ray Vision.
Honored to be here.
Thank you, sir.
If sometimes you feel the country is having a nervous breakdown, you're not alone. We've never, ever had a president or former president indicted. The passions that have been unleashed are intense and unpredictable. But even in these truly historic times, there are people like Congressman Ribble and Womp who are hopeful and, equally important, working to make our democracy survive. Of course, in our system, it's the voters who decide. So what are you going to do to keep democracy? We can't afford to sit back and hope someone will save us. We need to get involved and take action. You have the power. Now use it. Have a question about politics? Write me, and I'll answer you on the next episode. Go to thexray.org. I want to thank my guests, Congressman Reed Ribble and Zach Womp. And I also want to thank the production team, Nicole Legacy, Sydney Richards, and Renee Pineda. And I want to thank you for joining me on The X-Ray. I'm Fernando Espuelas. For more information on this podcast, check out thexray.org and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.
The X-Ray with Fernando Espuelas is an editorially independent production of Issue 1.